Mia takes this one square on the chin. I don't hate you. I don't think I ever really did. It was just anger. And once I faced it head on, once I understood it, it dissipated. She looks down, takes a deep breath, and exhales a tornado. I know I owe you some kind of an apology. I've been trying to get it out all night, but it's like those words, apology, sorry, are too measly for what you deserve. She shakes her head. I know what I did to you was so wrong, but at the time it also felt so necessary to my survival. I don't know if those two things can both be true, but that's how it was. If it's any comfort, after a while, when it didn't feel necessary anymore, when it felt hugely wrong, all I was left with was the magnitude of my mistake, of my missing you. And I had to watch you from this distance, watch you achieve your dreams, live what seemed like this perfect life. It's not perfect, I say. I get that now, but how was I supposed to know? You were so very, very far from me. And I'd accepted that as my punishment for what I'd done. And then, she trails off. What? She takes a gulp of air and grimaces. And then Adam Wilde shows up at Carnegie Hall on the biggest night of my career. And it felt like more than a coincidence. It felt like a gift. From them. For my first recital ever, they gave me a cello. And for this one, they gave me you. Every hair on my body stands on end, my whole body alert with a chill. She hastily wipes tears from her eyes with the back of her hand and takes a deep breath. Here, are you going to take this thing or what? I haven't tuned it for a while. I used to have dreams like this. Mia back from the not dead, in front of me, alive to me. But it got so even in the dreams I knew they were unreal and could anticipate the blare of my alarm. So I'm kind of listening now, waiting for the alarm to go off. But it doesn't. And when I close my fingers around the guitar, the wood and strings are solid and root me to the earth. They wake me up, and she's still here. And she's looking at me, at my guitar, and at her cello, and at the clock on the windowsill. And I see what she wants, and it's the same thing I've wanted for years now, but I can't believe that after all this time, and now that we're out of time, she's asking for it. But still, I give a little nod. She plugs in the guitar, tosses me the cord, and turns on the amp. Can you give me an E? I ask. Mia plucks her cello's E string. I tune from that, and then I strum an A minor. And as the cord bounces off the walls, I feel that dash of electricity shimmy up my spine in a way it hasn't done for a long, long time. I look at Mia. She's sitting across from me, her cello between her legs. Her eyes are closed, and I can tell she's doing that thing, listening for something in the silence. Then all at once, Mia seems to have heard what she needs to hear. Her eyes are open and on me again, like they never left. She picks up her bow, gestures toward my guitar with a slight tilt of her head. Are you ready? She asks. There are so many things I'd like to tell her. Top among them is that I've always been ready. But instead, I turn up the amp, fish a pick out of my pocket, and just say yes. Chapter 21. We play for what seems like hours, days, years, or maybe it's seconds. I can't even tell anymore. We speed up, then slow down. We scream our instruments. We grow serious. We laugh. We grow quiet, then loud. My heart is pounding. My blood is grooving. My whole body is thrumming as I'm remembering. Concert doesn't mean stand up like a target in front of thousands of strangers. It means coming together. It means harmony. When we finally pause, I'm sweating and Mia's panting hard, like she's just sprinted for miles. We sit there in silence, the sound of our rapid breaths slowing in tandem, the beats of our hearts steadying. I look at the clock. It's past 5. Mia follows my gaze. She lays down her bow. What now? She asks. Schubert? Ramones? I say, though I know she's not taking requests. But all I can think to do is keep playing, because for the first time in a long time, there's nothing more I want to do. And I'm scared of what happens when the music ends. Mia gestures to the digital clock flashing ominously from the windowsill. I don't think you'll make your flight. I shrug, never mind the fact that there are at least 10 other flights to London tonight alone. Can you make yours? I don't want to make mine, she says shyly. I have a spare day before the recitals begin. I can leave tomorrow. All of a sudden, I picture Aldous pacing in Virgin's departure lounge, wondering where the hell I am, calling a cell phone that's still sitting on some hotel nightstand. I think of Bryn out in L.A., unaware of an earthquake going down here in New York that's sending a tsunami her way. And I realize that before there's a next, there's a now that needs attending to. I need to make some phone calls, I tell Mia, to my manager, who's waiting for me, and to Bryn. Oh, right. Of course, she says, her face falling as she rushes to stand up, almost toppling her cello in her fluster. The phone's downstairs, and I should call Tokyo, except I'm pretty sure it's the middle of the night, so I'll just email and call later. And my travel agent... Mia, I interrupt. What? We'll figure this out. Really? She doesn't look so sure. I nod, though my own heart is pounding and the puzzle pieces are whirling as Mia places the cordless phone in my hand. I go into her garden where it's private and peaceful in the afternoon light, the summer cicadas chirping up a storm. Aldous picks up on the first ring and the minute I hear his voice and start talking, reassuring him that I'm okay, the plans start coming out of my mouth as though long, long contemplated. I explain that I'm not coming to London now, that I'm not making any music video or doing any interviews, but that I'll be in England for the kickoff of our European tour, and that I'll play every single one of those shows. The rest of the plan that's formulating in my head, part of which already solidified in some nebulous way last night on the bridge, I keep to myself, but I think Aldous senses it. I can't see Aldous, so I can't know if he blinks or flinches or looks surprised, but he doesn't miss a beat. You'll honor all your tour commitments? He repeats. What am I supposed to say to the band? They can make the video without me if they want. I'll see them at the Guildford Festival, I say, referring to the big music festival in England that we're headlining to kick off our tour. And I'll explain everything then. Where are you going to be in the meantime, if anyone needs you? Tell anyone not to need me, I answer. The next call is harder. I wish I hadn't chosen today to give up smoking. Instead, I do the deep breathing exercises like the doctors showed me and just dial. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with 10 digits, right? I thought that might be you, Bryn says when she hears my voice. Did you lose your phone again? Where are you? I'm in New York still, in Brooklyn. I pause. With Mia. Stone's silence fills the line, and I fill that silence with a monologue that's, what, I don't know. A running explanation of the night that happened by accident, an acknowledgement that things never were right between us, right the way she wanted them to be, and as a result, I've been a dick of a boyfriend. I tell her I hope she'll do better with the next guy. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that, she says with an attempt at a cackle, but it doesn't quite come out that way. There's a long pause. I'm waiting for her tirade, her recriminations, all the things I have coming, but she doesn't say anything. Are you still there? I ask. Yeah, I'm thinking. About what? I'm thinking about whether I'd rather she'd have died. Jesus, Bryn. Oh, shut up. You don't get to be the outraged one, not right now. And the answer's no, I don't wish her dead. She pauses. Not so sure about you, though. Then she hangs up. I stand there, still clutching the phone to my ear, taking in Bryn's last words, wondering if there might have been a shred of absolution in her hostility. I don't know if it matters, because as I smell the cooling air, I feel release and relief wash over me. After a while, I look up. Mia's standing at the sliding glass door, awaiting the all clear. I give her a dazed wave, and she slowly makes her way to the bricked patio where I'm standing, still holding the phone. She grabs hold of the top of the phone, like it's a relay baton, about to be passed off. Is everything okay? She asks. I'm freed, shall we say, from my previous commitments. Of the tour? She sounds surprised. I shake my head. Not the tour, but all the crap leading up to it. And my other, entanglements.
Oh.
We both just stand there for a while, grinning like goofballs, still grasping the cordless. Finally, I let it go and then gently detach the receiver from her grasp and place it on the iron table, never releasing my grip of her hand. I run my thumb over the calluses on her thumb and up and down the bony ridge of her knuckles and wrist. It's at once so natural and such a privilege. This is Mia I'm touching, and she's allowing it. Not just allowing it, but closing her eyes and leaning into it. Is this real? Am I allowed to hold this hand? I ask, bringing it up to my stubbly cheek. Mia's smile is melting chocolate. It's a kick-ass guitar solo. It's everything good in this world. Hmm, she answers. I pull her to me. A thousand suns rise from my chest. Am I allowed to do this? I ask, taking both of her arms in mine and slow dancing her around the yard. Her entire face is smiling now. You're allowed, she murmurs. I run my hands up and down her bare arms. I spin her around the planters, bursting with fragrant flowers. I bury my head into her hair and breathe the smell of her, of the New York City night that's seared into her. I follow her gaze upward to the heavens. So do you think they're watching us? I ask, as I give the scar on her shoulder the slightest of kisses and feel arrows of heat shoot through every part of me. Who? Mia asks, leaning into me, shivering slightly. Your family. You seem to think they keep tabs on you. You think they can see this? I loop my arms around her waist and kiss her right behind her ear, the way that used to drive her crazy. The way that, judging by the sharp intake of breath and the nails that dig into my side, still does. It occurs to me that there's seemingly something creepy in my line of questioning, but it doesn't feel that way. Last night, the thought of her family knowing my actions shamed me, but now, it's not like I want them to see this, but I want them to know about it, about us. I like to think they give me some privacy, she says, opening up like a sunflower to the kisses I'm planting on her jaw. But my neighbors can definitely see this. She runs her hand through my hair, and it's like she electrocuted my scalp, if electrocution felt so good. Howdy, neighbor, I say, tracing lazy circles around the base of her clavicle with my finger. Her hands dip under my t-shirt, my dirty, stinky, thank-you, lucky black t-shirt. Her touch isn't so gentle anymore. It's probing, the fingertips starting to tap out a Morse code of urgency. If this goes on much longer, my neighbors are going to get a show, she whispers. We are performers, after all, I reply, slipping my hands under her shirt and running them up the length of her long torso, then back down again. Our skins reach outward like magnets long deprived of their opposite charge. I run my finger along her neck, her jawline, and then cup her chin in my hand, and stop. We stand there for a moment, staring at each other, savoring it. And then all at once, we slam together. Mia's legs are off the ground, wrapped around my waist, her hands digging in my hair, my hands tangled in hers, and our lips. There isn't enough skin, enough spit, enough time for the lost years that our lips are trying to make up for as they find each other. We kiss. The electric current switches to high. The lights throughout all of Brooklyn must be surging. Inside, Mia half orders, half begs, and with her legs still wrapped around me, I carry her back into her tiny home, back to the couch where only hours before we'd slept, separately, together. This time, we're wide awake, and all together. We fall asleep, waking in the middle of the night, ravenous. We order takeout, eat it upstairs in her bed. It's all like a dream. Only the most incredible part is waking up at dawn, with Mia. I see her sleeping form there and feel as happy as I've ever been. I pull her to me and fall back asleep. But when I wake again a few hours later, Mia's sitting on a chair under the window, her legs wrapped in a tight ball, her body covered in an old afghan that her grand crocheted, and she looks miserable, and the fear that lands like a grenade in my gut is almost as bad as anything I've ever feared with her. and that's saying a lot. All I can think is, I can't lose you again. It really will kill me this time. What's wrong? I ask, before I lose the nerve to ask it and do something dumb like walk away before my heart gets truly incinerated. I was just thinking about high school, Mia says sadly.
That would put anyone in a foul mood.
Mia doesn't take the bait. She doesn't laugh. She slumps in the chair. I was thinking about how we're in the same boat all over again. When I was on my way to Juilliard and you were on your way to, well, where you are now. She looks down, twists the yarn from the blanket around her finger until the skin at the tip goes white. Except we had more time back then to worry about it. And now we have a day, or had a day. Last night was amazing, but it was just one night. I really do have to leave for Japan in like 7 hours. And you have the band, your tour. She presses against her eyes with the heels of her hands.
Mia, stop.
My voice bounces off her bedroom walls. We are not in high school anymore. She looks at me, a question hanging in the air.
Look, my tour doesn't start for another week.
A feather of hope starts to float across the space between us. And you know, I was thinking I was craving some sushi. Her smile is sad and rueful, not exactly what I was going for.
You'd come to Japan with me? She asks.
I'm already there.
I would love that. But then what? I mean, I know we can figure something out, but I'm going to be on the road so much, and...
How can it be so unclear to her when it's like the fingers on my hand to me?
I'll be your plus one, I tell her. Your groupie, your roadie, your whatever. Wherever you go, I go. If you want that.
If you don't, I understand.
No, I want that. Trust me, I want it. But how would that work with your schedule, with the band?
I pause. Saying it out loud will finally make it true. There is no more band. For me, at least. I'm done. After this tour, I'm finished.
No!
Mia shakes her head with such force the long strands of her hair thwack the wall behind her. The determined look on her face is one I recognize all too well, and I feel my stomach bottom out.
You can't do that for me, she adds, her voice softening. I won't take any more free passes.
Free passes?
For the last 3 years, everyone except maybe the Juilliard faculty has given me a free pass. Worse yet, I gave myself a free pass, and that didn't help me at all.
I don't want to be that person who just takes things. I've taken enough from you. I won't let you throw away the thing you love so much to be my caretaker or porter.
That's just it, I murmur.
I've sort of fallen out of love with music.
Because of me,
Mia says mournfully.
Because of life, I reply. I'll always play music. I may even record again, but right now I just need some blank time with my guitar to remember why I got into music in the first place.
I'm leaving the band whether you're part of the equation or not. And as for caretaking, if anything, I'm the one who needs it. I'm the one with the baggage. I try to make it sound like a joke, but Mia always could see right through my bullshit. The last 24 hours have proven that. She looks at me with those laser beam eyes of hers.
You know, I thought about that a lot these last couple of years, she says in a choked voice. About who was there for you. Who held your hand while you grieved for all that you'd lost?
Mia's words rattle something loose in me, and suddenly there are tears all over my damn face again. I haven't cried in 3 years, and now this is like the second time in as many days.
It's my turn to see you through, she whispers, coming back to me and wrapping me in her blanket as I lose my shit all over again.
She holds me until I recover my Y chromosome. Then she turns to me, a slightly faraway look in her eyes.
Your festival's next Saturday, right?
She asks. I nod.
I have the two recitals in Japan and one in Korea on Thursday, so I could be out of there by Friday. And you gain a day back when you travel west. And I don't have to be at my next engagement in Chicago for another week after that. So if we flew directly from Seoul to London.
What are you saying? She looks so shy when she asks it, as if there's a snowball's chance in hell that I'd ever say no, as if this isn't what I've always wanted.
Can I come to the festival with you?
Chapter 22.
How come I never get to go to any concerts?
Teddy asked. We were all sitting around the table, Mia, Kat, Denny, Teddy, and me, the third child, who'd taken to eating over. You couldn't blame me. Denny was a way better cook than my mom.
What's that, little man?
Denny asked, spooning a portion of mashed potatoes onto Teddy's plate next to the grilled salmon and spinach that Teddy had tried, unsuccessfully, to refuse.
I was looking at the old photo albums, and Mia got to go to all these concerts all the time. When she was a baby, even. And I never even got to go to one. And I'm practically 8.
You just turned 7 5 months ago, Kat guffawed.
Still, Mia went before she could walk. It's not fair.
And whoever told you that life was fair? Kat asked, raising an eyebrow.
Certainly not me. I am a follower of the school of hard knocks.
Teddy turned toward an easier target.
Dad!
Mia went to concerts because they were my shows, Teddy. It was our family time.
And you do go to concerts, Mia said. You come to my recitals.
Teddy looked as disgusted as he had when Denny had served him the spinach.
That doesn't count. I want to go to loud concerts and wear the mufflers.
The mufflers were the giant headphones Mia had worn as a little kid when she'd been taken to Denny's old band's shows. He'd been in a punk band, a very loud punk band. The mufflers have been retired, I'm afraid, Denny said. Mia's dad had long since quit his band. He now was a middle school teacher who wore vintage suits and smoked pipes.
You could come to one of my shows, I said, forking a piece of salmon.
Everyone at the table stopped eating and looked at me, the adult members of the Hall family each giving me a different, disapproving look. Danny just looked tired at the can of worms I'd opened. Kat looked annoyed for the subversion of her parental authority, and Mia, who, for whatever reason, had this giant church-state wall between her family and my band, was shooting daggers. Only Teddy, up on his knees in his chair, clapping, was still on my team.
Teddy can't stay up that late, Kat said. You let Mia stay up that late when she was little, Teddy shot back.
We can't stay up that late, Denny said wearily.
And I don't think it's appropriate, Mia huffed.
Immediately I felt the familiar annoyance in my gut, because this was the thing I never understood. On one hand, music was this common bond between Mia and me being an all-rock guy had to be part of her attraction. And we both knew that the common ground we'd found at her family's house, where we hung out all the time, made it like a haven for us. But she'd all but banned her family from my shows. In the year we'd been together, they'd never been. Even though Denny and Kat had hinted that they'd like to come, Mia was always making up excuses why this show or that was not the right time.
Appropriate? Did you just say that it's not appropriate for Teddy to come to my show?
I asked, trying to keep my voice level.
Yes, I did.
She couldn't have sounded more defensive or snippy if she'd tried. Kat and Denny flashed each other a look. Whatever annoyance they had with me had turned to sympathy. They knew what Mia's disapproval felt like.
Okay, first off, you're 16. You're not a librarian, so you're not allowed to say appropriate. And second of all, why the hell isn't it?
All right, Teddy, Kat said, scooping up Teddy's dinner plate. You can eat in the living room in front of the TV.
No way, I want to watch this.
SpongeBob? Denny offered, pulling him by the elbow.
By the way, I said to Denny and Kat, the show I was thinking of is this big festival coming up on the coast next month. It'll be during the day, on a weekend, and outside, so not as loud. That's why I thought it'd be cool for Teddy, for all of you, actually.
Kat's expression softened. She nodded.
That does sound fun.
Then she gestured to Mia as if to say, but you've got bigger fish to fry. The three of them shuffled out of the kitchen. Mia was slunk all the way down in her chair, looking both guilty and like there was no way in hell she was going to give an inch.
What's your problem? I demanded. What's your hang-up with your family and my band? Do you think we suck so badly?
No, of course not.
Do you resent me and your dad talking music all the time?
No, I don't mind the rock talk. So what is it, Mia?
The tiniest rebel teardrops formed in the edges of her eyes, and she angrily swatted them away.
What? What is the matter?
I asked, softening. Mia wasn't prone to crocodile tears, or to any tears, really. She shook her head, lips sealed shut.
Will you just tell me?
It can't be worse than what I'm thinking, which is that you're ashamed of shooting Star because you think we reek to holy hell. She shook her head again.
You know that's not true. It's just...
She paused, as if weighing some big decision. Then she sighed.
The band. When you're with the band, I already have to share you with everyone. I don't want to add my family to that pot, too.
Then she lost the battle and started to cry. All my annoyance melted.
You dumbass, I crooned, kissing her on the forehead. You don't share me. You own me.
Mia relented. Her whole family came to the festival. It was a fantastic weekend. 20 Northwest bands, not a rain cloud in sight. The whole thing went down in infamy, spawning a live recorded CD and a series of festivals that continue to this day. Teddy had insisted on wearing the mufflers, so Kat had spent an hour grumbling and digging through boxes in the basement until she'd found them. Mia generally liked to hang backstage at shows, but when Shooting Star played, she was right in front of the stage, just clear of the mosh pit, dancing with Teddy the whole time.
Chapter 23. First you inspect me, then you dissect me, then you reject me. I wait for the day that you'll resurrect me. Animate. Collateral Damage, Track 1.
When our flight lands in London, it's pissing down rain, so it feels like home to both of us. It's 5 in the afternoon when we get in. We're due in Guildford that evening. We play the next night. Then it's countdown till total freedom. Mia and I have worked out a schedule for the next 3 months while I'm touring and she's touring. Breaks here and there, where we can overlap, visit, see each other.
It's not going to be delightful, but compared to the last 3 years, it'll still feel like heaven.
It's past 8 when we get to the hotel. I've asked Aldous to book me at the same place as the rest of the band, not just for the festival, but the duration of the tour. Whatever their feelings are going to be about my leaving Shooting Star, sleeping 2 miles away ain't going to minimize them. I haven't mentioned Mia to Aldous or anyone, and miraculously, we've managed to keep her name out of the tabloids so far. No one seems to know that I'd spent the last week in Asia with her. Everyone was too busy buzzing about Bryn's new love interest, some Australian actor. There's a note at the front desk informing me that the band is having a private dinner in the atrium and asking me to join them. I suddenly feel like I'm being led to my execution, and after the 15-hour trip from Seoul, would like nothing more than to shower first, just maybe see them tomorrow. But Mia has her hand on my side.
No, you should go.
You come too?
I feel bad asking her. She just played 3 intensely amazing and crazily well-received concerts in Japan and Korea, and then flew halfway around the world and directly into my psychodrama. But all of this will be bearable if she's with me.
Are you sure?
She asks.
I don't want to intrude.
Trust me, if anyone's intruding, it's me. The bellman grabs our stuff to take to our room, and the concierge leads us across the lobby. The hotel is in an old castle, but it's been taken over with rockers and a bunch of different musicians nod and hey me, but I'm too nervous right now to respond. The concierge leads us to a dimly lit atrium. The band's all in there, along with a giant buffet serving a traditional English roast. Liz turns around first. Things haven't been the same between the two of us since that Collateral Damage tour. But the look she gives me now, I don't know how to describe it. Like I'm her biggest disappointment in life. But she tries to rise above it, to tamp it down, to act all casual, like I'm just one of the fans, one of the hangers-on, one of the many people who want something from her that she's not obliged to give.
Adam,
she says with a curt nod.
Liz, I begin cautiously. Hey, asshole, nice of you to join us.
Fitzy's irrepressible voice is both sarcastic and welcoming, like he just can't decide which way to go. Mike doesn't say anything. He just pretends I don't exist. And then I feel the brush of Mia's shoulder as she steps out from behind me.
Hi, guys,
she says. Liz's face goes completely blank for a moment, like she doesn't know who Mia is. Then she looks scared, like she's just seen a ghost. Then my strong, tough, butchy drummer, Her lower lip starts to tremble, and then her face crumples.
Mia?
She asks, her voice quivering.
Mia?
She asks, louder this time.
Mia!
She says, the tears streaming down her face right before she tackles my girl in a hug. When she's released her, she holds Mia at arm's length and looks at her, and then back at me, and then back at Mia.
Mia?
She shouts, both asking and answering her own question. Then she turns to me, and if I'm not forgiven, then at least I'm understood. The rain keeps up throughout the next day.
Lovely English summer we're having,
everyone jokes. It's become my habit to barricade myself at these types of giant festivals, but realizing that this is probably my last one for a while, at least as a participant, I slip inside the grounds, listen to some of the bands on the side stages, catch up with some old friends and acquaintances, and even talk to a couple of rock reporters. I'm careful not to mention the breakup of the band. That'll come out in time, and I'll let everyone else decide how to release this news. I do, however, briefly comment on Brin's and my split, which is all over the tabloids anyhow. Asked about my new mystery woman, I simply say, no comment. I know this will all come out soon enough, and while I want to spare Mia the circus, I don't care if the whole world knows we're together. By the time our 9 p.m. slot rolls around, the rain has subsided to a soft mist that seems to dance in the late summer twilight. The crowd has long since accepted the slosh. There's mud everywhere, and people are rolling around in it like it's Woodstock or something. Before the set, the band was nervous. Festivals do that to us. A bigger ante than regular concerts, even stadium shows. Festivals have exponentially larger crowds, and crowds that include our musician peers. Except tonight, I'm calm. My chips are all cashed out. There's nothing to lose. Or maybe I've already lost it and found it, and whatever else there might be to lose, it's got nothing to do with what's on this stage. Which might explain why I'm having such a good time out here, pounding through our new songs on my old Les Paul Jr., another piece of history brought back from the dead. Liz did a double take when she saw me pull it out of its old case.
I thought you got rid of that thing, she'd said.
Yeah, me too, I'd replied, tossing off a private smile at Mia. We race through the new album and then throw in some bones from Collateral Damage, and before I know it, we're almost at the end of the set. I look down at the set list that's duct taped to the front of the stage. Scrawled there in Liz's block lettering is the last song before we leave for the inevitable encore. Animate. Our anthem, our old producer Gus Allen called it. The angstiest screed on Collateral Damage, critics called it. Probably our biggest hit of all. It's a huge crowd pleaser on tours because of the chorus, which audiences love to chant.
It's also one of the few songs we've ever done with any kind of production. A string section of violins right at the top of the recorded track, though we don't have those for the live version.
So as we launch into it, it's not that rolling howl of the crowd's excitement that I hear, but the sound of her cello playing in my head. For a second, I have this vision of just the two of us in some anonymous hotel room somewhere, dickering around, her on her cello, me on my guitar, playing this song I wrote for her. And shit, if that doesn't make me so damn happy. I sing the song with all I've got. Then we get to the chorus. Hate me, devastate me, annihilate me, recreate me, recreate me. Won't you recreate me? On the album, the chorus is repeated over and over, a rasp of fury and loss, and it's become a thing during shows for me to stop singing and turn the mic out toward the audience and let them take over. So I turn the mic toward the fields, and the crowd just goes insane, singing my song, chanting my plea. I leave them at it, and I take a little walk around the stage. The rest of the band sees what's going on, so they just keep repping the chorus. When I get closer to the side of the stage, I see her there, where she always felt most comfortable, though for the foreseeable future, she'll be the one out here in the spotlight, and I'll be the one in the wings, and that feels right, too. The audience keeps singing, keeps making my case, and I just keep strumming until I get close enough to see her eyes. And then I start singing the chorus, right to her, and she smiles at me. And it's like we're the only two people out here, the only ones who know what's happening, which is that this song we're all singing together is being rewritten. It's no longer an angry plea shouted to the void. Right here on this stage, in front of 80,000 people, it's becoming something else. This is our new vow. This is Dan Bittner. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Where She Went by Gail Forman. This program was executive produced by Patty Perus and produced and directed by Garrett Scott. Where She Went is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., copyright 2011. All rights reserved. The book Where She Went is available wherever Dutton books are sold.